Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. For the next 30 minutes, whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join us as we explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started. Sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. It's Thursday, the 14th of November. On our program today, a new poll shows growing support for the Government of National Unity. We'll examine the massive cost of diabetes on the South African health sector, how artificial intelligence tools will make the lives of financial portfolio managers a whole lot easier, and find out how student debt is impacting job prospects for South Africa's younger people. In the latest polling by the Institute for Race Relations, support for political parties within South Africa's Government of National Unity has risen, while support for parties outside the GNU, such as the MKP and the EFF, is declining. I want to start the program now with Herman Pretorius, who's head of strategic communications at the Institute. Herman, let's start off first of all and put the context, or put this into context with the sample size of your survey. It was fairly modest, wasn't it?
Well, it is modest, but it is sufficient in terms of basic market research standards. It was a sample size of 604, and that gives us a confidence level of 95% and a margin of error of 5%. So if we were to carry out this survey 100 times, in 95 of those instances, the responses on the questions in the survey will fall within the margin of error of 5%. But as ever, an opinion poll should not be taken on its own. It stands within a context of data. But we see some findings within this polling that is quite stark and well outside of the margin of error. So despite the poll perhaps not being absolutely accurate, as no poll can possibly be, it still contains very useful data.
All right, let's deep dive into some of the findings then. What specific factors have you discerned that is driving support for partners within the GNU?
Well, two questions really stand out. And the IRR has been carrying out this poll for the last decade at least. And we always ask respondents two questions about quality of life. Is your life better than, the same as, or worse than 5 years ago? And if we compare the 2024 data to 2023 and 2022, we see that the number of respondents saying life has gotten worse has been steadily declining, from 54% in 2022 down to 43%, pardon me, in 2024. So there is a sentiment of declining worse prospects, if I can put it that way. The other question crucial to understanding this is, looking ahead, do you think life 5 years from now will be better, the same as, or worse than today? Here, the category of worse has fallen from 44% in 2022 to 25% this year, and the category of better up from 34% in 2022 to 48% this year. Crucially, though, this optimism is cautious, because we also see the category of don't know rising steadily from 2022, 13%, then 16%, then 20% this year. So we do seem there seems to be a trend of cautious optimism with the political changes of the ANC losing their majority and a new collaborative government seeming to be behind the shifting, if brittle, positive narrative.
I find this particular conclusion interesting. Two-thirds of respondents believe the GNU will last its full term. I think that almost runs counter to initial conventional wisdom. What do you think is contributing to this confidence, or new confidence, among voters?
Well, I think if we look at the polling of the last 2 or 3 years, not just from the IRR, but other entities as well, we do see an appetite for collaborative politics. So in this question, in that two-thirds saying they expect the GNU to hold for this full parliamentary term, there's probably a bit of wish fulfillment thinking going on, saying we expect it to, we want it to. It is the type of politics that South Africans want, where parties work together, and that is why that number is so high. It isn't perhaps a fully realistic reflection of what is actually going to happen, but it captures the sentiment that this situation currently seems to have the benefit of the doubt of South Africans.
And I'm correct in saying there has been a slight shift in policy priority as far as voters are concerned.
Yes, and here we see something that I cannot emphasize enough, and that is the extent to which socioeconomic aspirations are shared across demographic divides and racial divides in the country. We methodologically try to be as fair as possible. We have a randomized list of 11 priorities, and then we give respondents the question, what are the two issues you think should be the top priorities for the government? And then the randomized list allows them to pick two, and then we wait the data to get to a uniform answer. And unemployment and job creation, by far and away, the highest important issue, not just in general, but for all race relation, for all race groups. And then on the question of where jobs should come from, who should be the drivers of job creation, 63% of respondents say it must come through economic growth and allowing businesses to create jobs, with 33% saying government must create more public sector jobs through higher taxes. So this is a very positive socioeconomic consensus on which the GNU, if it has the political will to act, can find this sort of common ground, evidence-based, popular and effective policy program of saying, let's empower the job creators and make sure government removes the obstacles that has been in the way for so long.
You've also asked a question about the return of Jacob Zuma to frontline politics. Maybe you could elaborate for me on how his influence is affecting the EFF's standing, given the surge in the MK party.
So at the time we did this poll, the data seemed to indicate that MK had lost some support from 15% at the elections to 12% at the time of this poll at the end of September, the beginning of October. So that's a 3% drop for MK there. But the EFF, a similar 3% drop from around 10% to 7%. But the problem seems to be here, not necessarily in the data, but trying to understand what it is that is happening to these two parties who seem to be fishing in the same pond. If we look at a by-election that has just occurred in Limpopo, we see the situation of the EFF failing to put up a candidate at the same time as we see prominent EFF members joining MK. And in a way, if we look at Malema's rhetoric over the last decade, he has managed to be a successful insurgent politician, using a lot of the rhetoric that Zuma developed towards the end of his presidency. And at the ballot box, there was sort of this choice. Do you want the Elvis Tribute Act in the form of Julius Malema, or do you want to see Elvis on tour again with Zuma, Divare Jakob, as it were, being available again as a democratic choice? So it does seem to have crowded out the message of the EFF that they are the radical insurgent party. After all, it is difficult to maintain that particular image for 10 years, as the EFF has done successfully.
And just a final one, do you pose a question about immediate or short-term risks as far as the GNU is concerned and its stability?
Well, we ask whether the GNU in its current constellation of DA-IFP without MK-EFF is preferable to the inverse, an MK-EFF-GNU without the DA and the IFP. And there, the current constellation has a slight majority of 52% compared to 27% preferring a GNU with MK and the EFF within the tent. Now, as comfortable as that might sound, we should realize that a 30% oppositional bloc isn't isn't something to be sneered at. That is the oppositional bloc from which the DA and the IFP launched a successful bid to cross the aisle and enter government. And the GNU should be very aware of the fact that it is on a wait and see, benefit of the doubt, goodwill wicket currently. That isn't a guarantee to hold. And if the expectation that we discussed at the beginning of life getting better, if that fails to materialize, the GNU should expect that oppositional bloc to gain strength as voters start to get disappointed in the promise of the GNU if that happens. If the opposite happens and they deliver, we seem to be able to expect political benefit to the GNU parties perceived as responsible for improvements.
Thank you very much indeed. Herman Pretorius speaks for the Institute for Race Relations.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's estimated that almost 5 million South Africans between the ages of 20 to 79 are living with diabetes, with more than 50% of those remaining undiagnosed. And obviously, this is having a major impact on the economy. I'm in conversation now with Stavros Nikolaou from the Aspen Group. He's Senior Executive Strategic Trade. And I'm going to ask him firstly then, and welcome, how is diabetes being managed in South Africa? It's being described as having reached pandemic proportions. Let's get a sense then of the scale of this issue in South Africa.
It would probably not be an understatement to say that I feel a little like we were 24 years ago when we were getting to grips with the HIV pandemic. It was completely understated at the time. Underestimated, and I think the rest is history. We soon realized how calamitous a situation we're facing. Now, we could be facing a similar situation here with diabetes. So to give you some of the stats, 1 in 10 South Africans are diabetic. 1 in 2 are diagnosed. And we have a situation where diabetes has now become the single biggest killer in women in South Africa. So if we look at the male versus female stats on causes of death by disease, for males, number one is TB, number five is diabetes, and for females, it reverses. It's number one for diabetes and number six for TB.
Stavros, what is interesting about that is the problem as far as diagnosis is concerned, 1 in 2. What's the issue here?
The issue is a couple of things. I think firstly, almost a blissful ignorance, because it is a silent killer. It's no different to hypertension. You know, most people don't monitor their blood pressure, and then one day they kind of wake up and have a cardiovascular event. So there's that element of unawareness, and our role is to educate people. People can go and get screened. They can go and have their glucose tested at the nearest pharmacy. That will give them the first indications. People can look out for symptoms. But again, if we're not educating or running programs for our population, our citizens, they're not going to know what symptoms to look out for. So some of the basic symptoms could be things like increased thirst, waking up to go to the loo in the evening. These are very basic things. But if you don't know about them, you're not going to catch this early enough. And as with most diseases, the earlier you catch this, the better the outcomes. But what is sinister about diabetes is that we've seen we've seen an exponential growth of what we call type 2 diabetes. This is manifesting in much younger populations in our country and globally, incidentally. And these type 2 diabetics are usually overweight, obese, sedentary, what we call the typical couch kid playing TV games. This has sparked this pandemic of type 2 diabetes. Now, there's a strong link between being overweight and diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes. And the concern with type 2 diabetes is these patients present with significant underlying conditions, such as heart disease, such as high blood pressure, high lipids, and many other underlying conditions, which ultimately cause the major problems. And you know, if I can just spend 30 seconds on what the major problems are. So these diabetic patients, if left untreated, will eventually manifest with retinopathy, which is eye damage, eventually leading to blindness, kidney failure, what we call peripheral neuropathy. So the nerves in the peripheral parts of the bodies, usually the digits, the toes and fingers, become necrotic, sometimes have to be amputated. And then, of course, all the cardiovascular events, stroke, heart attacks, etc. So it's sinister because it's so multifaceted, Jeremy, and that's what we need to prevent.
Stavros, that's the individual impact, but unmanaged, there is also a suggestion that it could overwhelm South Africa's healthcare system if that's not already started. What are the specific pressures then on the system if this trend continues? And it would seem to me there's no indication that it is going to stop.
You know what COVID did for us? It drove home for the first time, I think, in the business community and in the broader economy, the type of impact that these public health challenges present. So they present not just to the public health system, but to economies, lives and livelihoods. And I think our healthcare system is already starting to be overwhelmed with diabetes. We know that the renal unit, where kidney disease patients are being treated, are completely overwhelmed. People are struggling to get into these units. So this is the early manifestation of it. But if we just reflect for a minute on what this is costing the economy. So to give you a sense, the largest medical scheme in our country has 150,000 patients that are diabetic. Remembering now, not everybody is diagnosed, only one in two are diagnosed. It's costing this scheme close on 9 billion rand, which is about 14 or 15% of the scheme's expenditure or risk that the scheme takes. So that's starting to place into focus. If it's 15% and you're not getting to grips with all the patients, and you're also not covering all the diagnoses, because sometimes it presents as a cardiovascular disease, which has been triggered by diabetes. So that gives you some type of indication of the scope of what we're going to be facing in future. The other interesting thing is globally, and as I said, we have a prevalence of 1 in 10 in our country. Globally, diabetes is consuming around 12% of global health expenditure, which equates to over $1 trillion. So that's trying to put it into focus. Now, the very last thing is this, of course, will impact productivity, our competitiveness in our companies, and it's going to affect balance sheets at the end of the day as well.
So a very quick answer in conclusion, what needs to change?
Three things. First of all, awareness. Awareness so that we get people to go and screen. Number two, we need improved diagnostics, and there are great diagnostics coming out. For example, there's a continuous glucose monitoring sensor that you can put on your arm. It monitors your glucose 24 hours a day. It's revolutionary. That in itself will help both diagnosis and management. And then thirdly, we need to strengthen our healthcare systems to give people access to both diagnosis and treatment. There's some fantastic new treatments on the horizon. The GLP-1 drugs are miraculous. And I think we need to give people access to these treatments.
Well, the warning certainly has been sounded on this World Diabetes Day. Stavros Nikolaou from Aspen, thank you very much indeed. Are you on the fence about buying an electric vehicle? In just over 10 years, one in two cars sold globally will be electric, and South Africa is finally catching up. Government says EV subsidies are on the cards, and October saw the launch of the country's first electric minibus. Go behind the EV headlines and listen to The Current, an Investec Focus Radio SA podcast for expert insights into the pros and cons of electrifying your ride.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Artificial intelligence is transforming industries worldwide, including the world of investments. As AI tools become more sophisticated, they are promising to make portfolio management smarter and, I guess, more efficient. But at what cost? I want to examine the advantages and risks now. And joining me is Peter van der Ross, Deputy Head of Multi-Asset and Portfolio Management at StanLib. Peter, first of all, then, welcome and start explaining how AI is currently used in portfolio management and where the advantages are.
We are definitely still experimenting. There's no question about that. And we'll continue to do that. And I think we'll have to do that for many years to come as the technology evolves. So we'll have to run quite hard to keep up with where the technology is.
So, Peter, at this point, is it too early to say whether AI is making portfolio management easier and more accurate, or the old argument about is there the danger of an over-reliance on the data that you've got and the algorithms that are, that you're using?
Yeah, so unfortunately, easy is still not a word that comes to mind when thinking about managing, navigating markets, managing portfolios. It's definitely made some aspects more efficient. As I've mentioned, we have incredible tools now where we can assimilate vast amounts of information. But as you allude to, some of the old adages still apply. So for example, just because I can now assimilate that much more information, there's a fallacy at play there as well that I've got to be mindful of, because more information doesn't always result in a better decision. So at some point, I've got to kind of cut the research agenda and say, right, we have enough information now. We've got to make a decision. More information is not going to help. But certainly efficiency, absolutely. And then, of course, there is a bit of circularity, because AI itself is impacting markets and what markets are doing. And we have to, and that's a new secular event we need to understand and navigate. So at the same time, it's making it easy for us to assimilate information, it's changing the world we're trying to understand, and that's always a moving target.
This is really interesting. How would you spot that circularity and then mitigate against it?
I don't think that's a new trend. You know, George Soros, I think it was, coined the term reflexivity, by which he meant the interplay between financial markets and the real world. And there's a... At times, that interaction creates virtuous circles, and at times it's vicious. And so, and these are not new developments. What happens now is, because the information flows faster, market cycles are probably speeding up, both the virtuous ones and the vicious ones. So it's probably same old dynamics. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But it's just new. The subject matter changes, but the dynamics are still very similar to what typically portfolios have needed to navigate through the years.
And Peter, how are you managing concern around bias?
So we don't let the machines make any decisions. It's hard enough to manage our own biases, but certainly we're nowhere near the point where we let the machines loose on making decisions. I think that is potentially one of the risks down the line. If too many market players are using similar algorithms, you're going to see concentration of certain types of risks and potentially more volatile cycles. But we're not at the stage where we're letting the machines loose. So it's still hopefully just human biases we need to manage at this stage.
I understand that. But inevitably, as AI gets better, it will be doing more of the heavy lifting, which means that the role of the human portfolio manager is going to have to change.
Absolutely. It will change. But ultimately, what is the job of a portfolio manager? Portfolio manager's job is to generate returns, but it's crucially by applying judgment and to act sensibly, to act in accordance with some sort of moral compass. Computer software can't do that yet. And all of those things, there are biases that come from human beings when we apply our own judgments. When we talk about a moral compass, those are human biases that computer software packages don't have yet. So, I mean, of course, eventually we'll have something called AGI, generalized intelligence, which will change that. But we're not there yet. I don't think that is something we need to worry about at this stage.
Well, that certainly is a glimpse into the future. Peter van der Ross, Deputy Head of Multi-Asset and Portfolio Management at StanLib, thank you very much indeed for that insight.
MoneyWeb at Midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
Let me finish the program with this. With more than 60% of South Africa's youth facing unemployment, many young graduates are finding themselves unable to access job opportunities due to unpaid tuition balance. The problem, of course, isn't limited to South Africa. Around the world, young people are struggling with student debt, and that is affecting their financial future and job prospects. I'm in conversation now with Dumisani Sibanda, Executive Head of Strategic Partnerships at the education finance provider Fundi. First of all, then, how are outstanding balances affecting employability within this cohort?
So the first area that we look at is let's talk about demand first, right? As everyone needs higher education, and you find that we have our aspirational institutions, and we apply and we get accepted, and you find that once we are accepted, there might be a requirement from institutions for us to pay a deposit, and we are good to go with our studies. And without thinking about the end of the year, what that will look like and the consequences of not paying your fees during the year. So that gives birth to outstanding balances. And that now talks to two things. First, the student can't proceed to the next year. And if the student is a final year student, they can't graduate without paying off their fees. And so now what happens is someone has gone to school, they probably passed their modules, but they can't access their results to get employment, and the results are required for them to get the employment, which the employment would help to pay back the funds on the outstanding balances, and that creates a catch-22 situation. And that's where we find ourselves with a lot of our South African students.
It really is a desperate situation for so many. Do you think the situation is getting worse?
Yeah, absolutely it is. The economy is not growing, and there's competition for skills in the market. And then at the same time, you find that there is also a growing disconnect between what the students are taught in tertiary education, where these skills mismatch with what the jobs are looking for. So even those that graduate and have their results, some can find a job, but you find that they are not work ready.
And it's not just an impact on the students themselves, but it also has a longer term impact on the economy if skills are not being pipelined into it.
Absolutely, there is. And what makes this situation worse is the fact that we are now in a connected world, and there are some skills that people can actually execute remotely. And so not just South Africans fighting for jobs in their economy. There are other students from other places as far as India who can actually execute the jobs remotely, and that makes it more difficult for our South African students.
So as far as the data goes that you have collected as an organization, is there a primary reason or reasons why students find themselves unable to settle their tuition fees? Or as you referenced earlier, is it just that basket of factors impacted by the high cost of living?
It's a mix of factors, but if we're to look at the data that we have, for instance, if you look at just the university space only, the universities themselves are battling with outstanding debt up to the tune of 20 billion plus. You know, and this is actually impacting their performance as far as efficiencies are concerned, and it leaves them without any other option but to use such a harsh collection method, which exacerbates the problem.
Typically, do you have a sense of how big an individual student debt might be at the end of 3 or 4 years of study?
Let me give you an example of one case that we're dealing with through our foundation. We have a foundation that does good out there, and it opens up to students to come and ask for help. We recently were dealing with a situation where two students came to us. One was studying at UCT. Of course, life happened, the financial challenges. They are going towards writing their exams now, and they've got a student statement bill of 90,000 rand. A second student is a third-year law student at Wits University. They came to us. They've got an outstanding student fee of 95,000 rand. And they can't pay for it. And they're saying, hey, I am about to write exams. I need help. This is what it looks like. So just using those two data points, it gives an indication of what it looks like out there.
And it can be unbelievably demoralizing, particularly when you've got a set of complicated exams to write. Does the student debt challenge in South Africa compare in any other way to countries that might be facing similar issues?
Yes, there's actually a couple of comparisons. So when you look at financial performance, particularly of a South African economy, the easiest example to look at is Latin America, because the conditions are similar. we are even better than Latin America because we've got political stability. But economically, we are facing similar challenges. And even if you were to look at the U.S. itself, education is unbelievably expensive in the USA. And if South African student decides to go and study in Europe, it's also a very steep journey that one gets to embark on. Let me quantify. If someone goes to study in Europe, they particularly pay almost five times than what a UK resident pays in the same environment. And you can just imagine how difficult that looks like.
So in your opinion then, are there policy changes that could help relieve this burden for students?
I think there could be. And let me touch on one tangible one. So one of the barriers for unemployment for graduates, whether they owe fees or not, is experience, work experience. So our tertiary institutions, the bulk of them, they are focused on theoretical information as opposed to work-integrated learning. And unlike Europe and the US, some of the universities and tertiary institutions, they've actually structured programs to be feeders into industry and they work hand in hand. The economies are developed like that and the policies are developed to support that kind of supply. Germany is a very good case study to look at. They use the apprenticeship approach. And by the time someone gets to university, they sort of like have where they're going to have 1 year of practical application, which we are missing in this country. And I think that's one policy change that we might need to do for the bulk of our qualifications. Then allow me, Jeremy, to quote a statement I had at a conference in a month ago. It was a conference organized by Universities South Africa, a body that is where all the 26 universities participate. So one speaker there, you're saying each time he goes out to industry, he gets comments like, give us useful graduates, you know. And that sank my heart as I had listened to such a statement. Give us useful graduates. And that's predominantly a policy change that is required to produce useful graduates in the country.
And I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Dumisani Dibanda, Executive Head of Strategic Projects at the education finance provider Fundi, thank you very much for joining me today. And just before I say goodbye, on our last online poll, I asked you about the future of the Eskom City of Johannesburg power agreement. 75% of respondents saying they doubt it will hold, 9% saying it will, and 16% saying they have contingency plans. And relating to an earlier interview that we had, the use of artificial intelligence in investing, I'm good, I'm cautious, not for me. You can participate either via X or LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.